Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 7th of February, these are our main stories. A US appeals court denies Donald Trump's claim that he is immune from prosecution as a former president. The Israeli military tells the families of 31 hostages held in Gaza that their loved ones are dead. And an army of angry farmers forces the EU to abandon its plans to halve the use of pesticides.
Issues have escalated in recent years. Our farmers deserve to be listened to. I know that they are worried about the future of agriculture and about their future as farmers.
Also in this podcast, the former Chilean president Sebastian Piñera has died in a helicopter crash. And
if you think about the sort of dilemmas that they were wrestling with at the time, they are the biggest, most profound, most paradoxical, most important moral dilemmas that we're still wrestling with as a race.
Cillian Murphy on his starring role as the father of the atomic bomb in the multiple Oscar-nominated film Oppenheimer. Donald Trump may be the frontrunner to be the next Republican candidate for the US presidential election. Some polls suggest he could even beat President Biden. But Mr. Trump has been battling several criminal charges, including plotting to overturn the 2020 election. He's argued that he has presidential immunity, but now a US court has ruled against him, saying he can be prosecuted. Donald Trump described the ruling on his social media platform as nation-destroying, as I heard from our correspondent in Washington, Nomia Iqbal.
That's the kind of reaction that I think we expected from Donald Trump, but the three judges that came up with their ruling, they said that what Donald Trump was presenting here with his immunity claim would, I quote, collapse our system of separated powers by placing the president beyond the reach of all three branches. So their argument is, well, actually what he was suggesting would be, I would argue they would be saying, is nation destroying. But this is a major setback for him. This was his defense that he was relying on. But the judges were basically saying, look, if you can get immunity, then by that logic, as a president, you could sell state secrets, you could order the assassination of a political rival, not face any criminal consequences. And they have ruled that for the purposes of the election subversion case, former President Trump has become Citizen Trump and therefore should be treated like any other criminal defendant.
So he says he'll appeal. It looks like it's headed for the Supreme Court, doesn't it?
There are a few options here. So Trump's team might request that the full 11-judge DC Circuit Court of Appeals reviews and reconsider this case. That's probably not going to happen. And the appeals court has said that even if that sort of request did happen, the 6th January case can still proceed. But yes, one likely route is he can turn to the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court can refuse to hear the case. They might decide this is too politically charged, we're not going to touch it. But let's just say the Supreme Court refuses to hear the case. The election interference case can then return to its normal schedule. But let's just say the Supreme Court decides to put it on their docket. That pretty much guarantees that this trial could take place very close to Election Day. And that is a victory for Donald Trump. What he essentially wants is that this trial and all the other trials are delayed until after the presidential election in November.
So what is going to happen next? Because there, as you indicated, there are an awful lot of trials waiting to happen, aren't there?
At the moment, it's so unknown because we were expected the trial in DC to take place next month. We know that Donald Trump is planning to appeal. He's got until February the 12th to make that appeal. As I say, we'll see what the Supreme Court does. So will they let the lower court decision stand? They can also decide whether to put the January 6th trial on hold in the meantime. I'd be very surprised if the Supreme Court did get involved. It's a very politically charged case, but you never know. But at this stage, right now, we know that his election subversion case isn't happening as planned next month. But when it happens, we just don't know yet.
Nomia Iqbal in Washington. Hamas has delivered its response to the framework proposal for a new ceasefire in Gaza. The US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, said Washington was reviewing the response. He said he would discuss it with the Israeli government during his visit there on Wednesday. Mr. Blinken was speaking at a news conference in Doha with the Qatari Prime Minister on the latest leg of his shuttle diplomacy.
There's still a lot of work to be done, but we continue to believe that an agreement is possible and indeed essential. and we will continue to work relentlessly to achieve it. We're also determined to use any pause to continue to pave a diplomatic path forward to a just and lasting peace for the region. That is the best way to ensure that October 7th and the tragic loss of life by Israelis and Palestinians is not repeated.
Antony Blinken. On Tuesday, the Israeli military announced some devastating news for the families of the remaining hostages in Gaza. 31 of them are dead. Our correspondent in Jerusalem is Barbara Platasha.
This is something the Israeli military has now confirmed and, as you said, called up the families and given them that news, just as Mr. Blinken is in the region and talking about a ceasefire to try to get the rest of the hostages released. But there are still around 100, we believe, are being held in Gaza.
And this is going to only increase pressure on the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yes, there has been a lot of pressure on Mr. Netanyahu already from families of the hostages that have wanted to make the government a priority to reach a hostage deal instead of pressing ahead with the military operations because they're afraid that their relatives will be killed in the crossfire. The Israeli military and officials have been arguing is that as they put more pressure on Hamas, then Hamas is more likely to negotiate. And it also it puts them in a position to be able to rescue the remaining captives if necessary. But they have only managed to rescue one hostage so far and actually accidentally killed three of them. So I think for the hostage families, anything that suggests that family members are in danger is going to make them want to push for a hostage deal as soon as possible.
Antony Blinken going to Israel next. But is he any nearer to actually achieving either the release of hostages or a temporary ceasefire in Gaza?
Well, we were waiting for Hamas to respond to the proposal and now has given its response while Mr. Blinken is in the region. So that means that he has something concrete to discuss with the Israelis. He didn't say what that Hamas reply entailed, but a senior Hamas official who spoke to the BBC said the group had asked for a number of things, including a clear timetable for the reconstruction of Gaza and transferring the wounded to hospitals abroad. And we also saw that the group released a statement which made it pretty clear it wants any truce to lead to an end to the war. We also know, of course, that the Israelis have said there's no chance that this could lead to a permanent ceasefire. So that would likely continue to be a matter of negotiation. And Mr. Blinken said there was still a lot of work to be done. But those who drafted this proposal, including the Americans and the Egyptians and the Qataris, are hoping that it will lead to a lengthy ceasefire, which will see the return of the rest of the Israeli hostages and also get a dramatic amount of aid into Gaza and then lay the groundwork for a post-war arrangement. So the Americans are quite invested in this. And this is a development that will help Mr. Blinken move things forward or at least talk things further through with the Israelis on Wednesday.
Barbara Platasha in Jerusalem. Now let's return to a story that we reported on in our previous Global News podcast. The leader of a doomsday cult in Kenya who was charged on Tuesday with 191 counts of murder. Paul McKenzie and 29 others pleaded not guilty to starving hundreds of members to death before a court in the coastal town of Malindi. More than 400 bodies, including those of children, were exhumed from shallow graves on a piece of land thought to be owned by the controversial preacher. The BBC's Anne Soy met some of those who survived the cult and families of those who weren't so lucky. A warning, her report does include some upsetting testimony.
The pain of a father who's lost all his children. Stephen Witty breaks down repeatedly while narrating what happened to them. His wife, Bahati John, he says, followed the teachings of the controversial preacher, Paul McKenzie. He shows us his children's school uniforms and bags. He wanted them to go to school, but his wife didn't. The church she joined preached against formal education. So the couple fought over it, and he'd forcefully take the children to school himself.
I left for work. When I came back, I found there were no children. She only left the children's school uniforms and bags.
One day, he received alarming reports about her family. He went to Shakahola, an expansive forest northwest of the coastal city of Mombasa where he lives, to investigate. Nothing could have prepared him for what he found. Dead or dying children and emaciated followers of a cult that urged its members to fast until they met Jesus. He found only one grandson, whom he rescued, together with another child.
He experienced the death of his brothers. He saw them being starved by their parents. And that's a story that he will never forget. So he knew that was next, but it was lucky, he was rescued.
After children, women were the second group to be forced to starve. We meet one of the women survivors. She seems lost in thought. She watches chicken roam around her compound as she cuddles her one-year-old. She was pregnant with her when she went to Shakahola.
It was difficult for us. Imagine six men gang-raping you. They would pick us in tons. It was a church initially, but preaching stopped, and they started raping and killing people.
This is Shakahola Shopping Center. When Mackenzie first came here, the residents welcomed him. He said he'd moved here to farm. Then the residents heard that he ran a church. Not a problem to the locals. Their presence here was actually good for business. But then, suddenly, they stopped coming to the shops, and the red flags began to emerge. Changawa Mangi, the village elder, went to find out what was going on. What he saw there shocked him.
Some were frail, looking like they will die within hours. Others were stronger, but they didn't want to be rescued. They were asking the police, "Why are you disturbing us? Yet we want to go to Jesus. Won't you also die one day?"
Mackenzie has told the court he never forced anyone to starve. Some of his followers still believe in his teachings. But to families that lost their kin, the pain they now have to live with is immeasurable.
Anne Soy with that report. For weeks, angry farmers across Europe have been protesting against a combination of high fuel costs, cheap imports and mounting paperwork. They're also angry at the EU's green agenda, which includes proposals to halve pesticide use. Well, on Tuesday, the head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, announced it was abandoning plans to drastically reduce pesticide use in a concession to protesting farmers.
Issues have escalated in recent years. Our farmers deserve to be listened to. I know that they are worried about the future of agriculture and about their future as farmers. But they also know that agriculture needs to move to a more sustainable model of production so that their farms remain profitable in the years to come.
I asked our Europe regional editor, Danny Eberhardt, why did Ursula von der Leyen cave in now?
The EU Commission has been under sustained pressure from countries including France, where there was a major protest blocking the French capital. There was a separate protest today, obviously, in Spain. And a number of politicians have come to Brussels and said, look, we have to change this because it's becoming politically toxic. The Commission has already said that some of the regulations on land lying fallow, which is an idea to try to improve the quality of the soil and biodiversity, that there'll be more exemptions on that. The backdrop to all this, which is the important thing, is there's European elections coming up in June, Alex, and there are fears among some centrist pro-EU politicians that the far right and the far left will benefit from these sort of disputes. So this is why we're seeing the Commission move on some of these restrictions. The pesticide deal was part of the Green Deal, which is a whole series of measures that the Commission is rolling out to try to restore degraded ecosystems. And environmentalists will say it's all well and good saying that farmers can use chemical pesticides and not tackle that issue. But then you're having, at the same time, a collapse in biodiversity. So things like insect pollinators of crops are at very low levels across some parts of the EU. Soil health is not good, and the toxic chemicals are not good for the public health. So they accuse lobby groups, basically, of pushing to get these pesticide restrictions repealed. They said that that's why, for example, the European Parliament blocked the regulation earlier. So the regulation was in trouble anyway. And in some ways, it's an easy win for the Commission to say, look, we're showing willing, we're cutting back on some of these restrictions that the farmers are complaining about. But they haven't completely abandoned them either.
So are the farmers going to continue their protests?
I can confidently say there will be continued farmers' protests. As in many disputes, once you start getting concessions, the logic is that you may be able to get more, and a whole load of other nations, so Italy, Spain, Greece, Poland, Romania as well, will also continue.
Danny Eberhardt. The former president of Chile, Sebastian Piñera, has died in a helicopter crash. Reports say the aircraft had encountered bad weather in the south of the country. Our South America correspondent, Ione Wells, reports.
Chile's interior minister confirmed four people were involved in a helicopter crash on Tuesday. While three people survived, the former president, Sebastián Piñera, was killed. The army have recovered his body. Sebastián Piñera was a conservative politician who was the president of Chile from 2010 to 2014, and again from 2018 until last year. He was also a billionaire businessman, one of the richest men in Chile. Politicians around South America have paid tribute to Mr. Piñera. The former president of Argentina, Mauricio Macri, said he felt immense sadness for the death of his dear friend, and it was an irreplaceable loss. Iván Duque, the former president of Colombia, said he felt great sadness for the death of his friend.
Ione Wells. Still to come in the Global News podcast, why elephants are dying in big numbers in Sri Lanka.
When they come into conflict with farmers, they get annoyed because their crops are damaged. So they use what they call jaw bombs, where they mix the explosives with some food and keep it. When they eat it, then it explodes in their mouth.
Two years ago, Ethan Crumbly killed four of his classmates at his school in the US state of Michigan. He was 15 at the time, and the gun he used was given to him by his mother and father. A jury has now found Jennifer Crumbly guilty of involuntary manslaughter, which carries a prison sentence of up to 15 years. More from our North America correspondent, John Sudworth.
There have been all sorts of attempts amid this epidemic of gun violence in America to hold third parties accountable, but this is the first criminal case of this kind, and it's undoubtedly significant. In a pretty conservative part of middle America, a jury deciding that there was enough evidence that Jennifer Crumbly could have foreseen the actions of her son. There had been a number of warning signs, disturbing drawings that the school had brought to his parents' attention, but the argument in court was that they hadn't done enough to warn the school, and in fact, on the very same morning that they were contacted to say that there were concerns about their son, they allowed him to return to class without telling the school that he even owned a gun. He'd been bought a handgun as an early Christmas present. So that's what's at the heart of this case. But in terms of exactly what kind of precedent it sets, that will be for the next stages of the legal process, if indeed there is an appeal.
John Sudworth. King Charles has been seen in public for the first time since it was announced that he has cancer. He was sitting in the back of a car alongside the Queen, leaving his residence, Clarence House, in London. The King is believed to have spoken to his youngest son, Prince Harry, who returned to the UK from California. Our royal correspondent, Daniela Rolf, has been following developments.
As he was driven into Buckingham Palace, crowds gathered outside the main gates to catch a glimpse of the king. With him was his wife, Queen Camilla. The couple then travelled by helicopter to the Sandringham estate in Norfolk, where he will spend time between treatments. It is a place where those who work with him say he finds solace and happiness. Before the king left London, there was a family visitor to host. Straight from the airport to see his father, the Duke of Sussex is back in the UK, flying in from his home in California. Prince Harry spent around 45 minutes at Clarence House with his father. They hadn't seen each other since the coronation in May. Julian Payne, the King's former head of communications, said this was an important moment for father and son.
The royal family at its core is a family just like any other. And when a member of your family is unwell, you want to go and see them, you want to express your love and support, and you want to do what you can to help. It will be a very human reaction to a difficult challenge that the King is facing, and that will be what's lying behind it.
With the King clearing his diary and focusing on his cancer treatment and desk-based duties, other royal engagements are now for the wider family. The Conservative peer, Lord Dobbs, is a friend of the King. He has praised him for going public.
It is encouraging us to come out of the shadows, not to treat it as something which is so appalling you can't face up to it. I'm surviving cancer. My brother has survived six different cancers. It's not what it was 20 years ago. So it's a modern look from a modern monarchy about a very old-fashioned problem.
Buckingham Palace is now reworking the King's schedule. Official visits abroad are on hold. All decisions are dependent on how the King responds to treatment.
Daniela Rolf with that report. One of the world's leading experts on international law has claimed the International Criminal Court, the ICC, is involved in a turf war with other institutions. Philippe Sands has said this is preventing Ukraine from establishing a special tribunal to try Russia's leadership for the crime of aggression. The ICC is based in The Hague in the Netherlands. Our correspondent there is Anna Holligan.
And the tribunal at the heart of this alleged turf war is specifically focused on the crime of aggression. The crime of aggression, planning, initiation or execution of a large-scale and serious act of aggression using state military force. Philippe Sands said the reason why prosecuting this in the context of Russia is because it's the only way to reach the top table with any degree of certitude. So you might think this task would fall to the ICC, which is based here in The Hague, a court of last resort designed to hold the most powerful individuals to account for war crimes, crimes against humanity and genocide. But it doesn't have jurisdiction over alleged Russian crimes of aggression because Russia is not signed up to their own statute, which underpins the ICC. So speculation has been swirling for months about what a tribunal would look like, how it would be created. And now Philippe Sands has come up and said in a conference in London last week, attended by a number of Ukrainian ministers, that it's Karim Khan's fault. The ICC prosecutor, he says, is blocking the establishment of this tribunal because it's a matter of turf rather than principle. He wants the ICC to deal with any possible prosecution of President Putin. He doesn't want that to fall to an international ad hoc tribunal.
Briefly, any reaction from Mr. Khan?
Yes, he has denied these claims. He points to the unprecedented partnerships with Ukrainian authorities. He points out the ICC has been part of the joint investigation team which has been set up, also participating in the creation of the International Centre for the Prosecution of the Crime of Aggression. So denying that, but Karim Khan was once Philippe Sands' student, and so this really captures how complex this whole issue is.
Anna Holligan in The Hague. Sri Lanka's endangered elephants are dying at an unprecedented rate. In the past year alone, 470 elephants have died. Our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan, has been in Sri Lanka to investigate. He told my colleague James Reynolds what's behind the surge in deaths.
Once upon a time, Sri Lanka used to have thousands of elephants. Now the numbers have dwindled to less than 6,000. And in the last 10, 15 years, there has been increasing conflict between elephants and human beings because both are competing for the same resources. As Sri Lanka develops, the agricultural lands are increasing and lands are also taken over for industrial growth, for laying highways, big ports. And elephants, they move long distances. They have this habit of going from one area of Sri Lanka to another. It's not like a continuous territory like you have India, Bangladesh, Nepal, where elephants can cross boundaries and go into other countries. Here, it's an island.
It's an
nation.
Island, yeah.
So you have to go from south to the north or from east to the west. When they come into conflict with farmers and they get annoyed because their crops are damaged by the raiding elephants. So they use what they call jaw bombs, where they mix the explosives with some food and keep it. When they eat it, then it explodes in their mouth. And then they also have electric fencing, illegal fencing. So when they come into these electric fences, they get shocked and they die. And people use guns as well. But out of these 470, nearly half died of illnesses. They fight with each other, natural causes. But half of them are killed by humans. That is a worrying sign because this is the second consecutive year they have crossed 400 and highest on record last year.
You heard, Anbarasan, from a Sri Lankan man whose father was killed by an elephant. We'll play our audience that clip.
In my parents' house, the toilet is outside, about 25 meters from the house. When my father went to the toilet, suddenly an elephant attacked him. It was dark, and he didn't realize that the elephant was already inside our compound. My mother raised the alarm, and we all shouted and chased the elephant away. We rushed my father to hospital, but he died of his injuries 2 days later. We yet to recover from the shock. Even now, we are scared to go outside our house after 6 p.m. We are scared that elephants may be somewhere.
That was Sanjeev Bandara from Kirinda village in central Sri Lanka. To these people, elephants are a threat. They killed a relative there. And if conservationists say, well, you need to protect elephants, presumably Sanjeev and everyone in the village say, no, you need to protect humans.
It's a huge problem. What we don't see, if you go there as a tourist, you go to the forest to see the elephants, whereas you just go take the side roads, some of the mud roads, go into the villages, there is a completely different world existing because they're frightened. I have met a number of families there whose relatives were killed by the elephants. And there is a sort of curfew after 6 p.m. People don't go out of the houses. It's happening all across Sri Lanka. And this village is one of the areas what they call as front lines of human-animal conflict. So nobody goes out, even if you want to go to a friend's house for a meal or meeting a friend, unless it is very essential, they don't step out of the house because they don't know what is there. In fact, one of the government officials who was working with the community, he was telling us, we don't even come by car in this road in the night because the elephants might come across and they roam around freely.
And Barasan Etarajan speaking to James Reynolds. Now to a well-worn phrase, money can't buy happiness. Over the years, various studies have looked into whether it's true with conflicting results. Now, researchers have decided to speak to people beyond their traditional sample, indigenous tribes, to try to learn more. Stephanie Prentice told Nigel Adderley what they found.
It is worth looking at the sample this study used. It's decent. It's almost 3,000 people from 19 indigenous communities, and it's all around the world. What they found was that people living in these remote communities with what the team called very little money were as happy as the average person in high-income Western countries. In fact, some of them reported being happier. This, of course, goes against the idea that economic growth is the way to increase the well-being of people in low-income countries. And it goes against other global surveys in recent decades that support that sort of strategy, like the World Happiness Report. They tend to gather data from people in industrialized societies, perhaps overlooking people in small-scale ones where things like the exchange of money just plays a more minimal role in their everyday life. Now, while the team were very confident in concluding that many people in indigenous communities had high levels of satisfaction, what they admitted they didn't know was exactly why. And the lead researcher, he was from McGill University in BC, Canada, he called for more learning and said Western nations should deep dive into why this is.
Finland has been voted as the happiest country in the world for the last 6 years. So could that title now be under threat?
Well, four of those communities interviewed averaged out of happiness an 8 out of 10, while Finland, which is on that streak of being crowned the happiest place to live, again by the World Happiness Report, they had 7.9. Now, I actually went to Finland last summer when they were announced the happiest country, again, and interviewed people about it. And there is a real alchemy to this as to why people say they're so happy. I mean, in Finland's case, despite being a relatively wealthy nation, a lot of the reasons were very simple things like being happy outside in nature, being there often, spending time with loved ones, taking time out to sit in a sauna, preparing food, enjoying food. They also spoke to a lack of striving to be seen as wealthy or to even display their wealth. And while the researchers in this new study didn't have a why metric in place, they did speculate that indigenous communities experience more social support, spirituality, and more of that connection to nature.
Stephanie Prentice. On Sunday, it was Taylor Swift who stole the show at the Grammys, and next month it could be Oppenheimer, which leads the Oscars. The film focuses on the theoretical physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer, who led the effort to create the atomic bomb. Directed by Christopher Nolan, it's been a critical and commercial hit, with 13 nominations at both the British Film Academy Awards and the Oscars. Our culture editor, Katie Razzle, has been speaking to Cillian Murphy, whose portrayal of Oppenheimer has earned him Best Actor nominations.
World, but remember this day.
I read something about Oppenheimer that said he was more riddle than answer.
Cillian Murphy looks like the one to beat in the awards race for his transformation into J. Robert Oppenheimer, gaunt, morally torn, and the father of the atomic bomb.
I think most people looking at it would think you're the front runner, and I wonder if that's an uncomfortable place to be when it comes to the Oscars or indeed the BAFTAs.
Oh, I genuinely don't think about that. It's kind of wasted energy.
Our work here will ensure a peace mankind has never seen.
Oppenheimer and a team of scientists working for the US government created the bomb that was used controversially to end the Second World War. a weighty subject for director Christopher Nolan and a commercial hit. The film's taken nearly £800 million at the box office.
People come up to me in the street and say that they've seen the film 4 and 5 times, which is just phenomenal and very flattering.
When Christopher Nolan comes to you and says, I want you to play the theoretical physicist, yeah, Oppenheimer, how do you know that you're going to be able to do it? Can you practice for it in any way?
I need to not know. If I know instantly I can do that, I generally don't take the part, because then it doesn't represent any kind of challenge to me. And you never kind of fully know you've got it.
I don't know if we can be trusted with such a weapon.
Clearly it takes a while from when you make a film to when it comes out.
Yeah.
I wonder, when you were making it, did it feel like a very timely film? And do you feel it's timely now?
Russia had just invaded Ukraine just before we started shooting, so of course it was on everyone's mind. We were all living in a nuclear world because of Oppenheimer, and it seems to ebb and flow, the level of threat, right? It's always there. It's like this sort of sword of Damocles, and people choose to think about it or not. But I think good writing is always prescient. Oppenheimer's story is a story of the 20th century. It has to be entertaining primarily, but if it's provocative and makes you think about what's happening in the world today, I think that's a really good bonus.
We imagine a future, and our imaginings horrify us.
And it is a film about theoretical physics.
Yeah.
Did you ever worry that it wouldn't be appreciated?
This is actually a very human story. And if you think about the sort of dilemmas that they were wrestling with at the time, they are the biggest, most profound, most paradoxical, most important kind of moral dilemmas that we're still wrestling with as a race.
And were you good at maths and science at school? Did you understand the equations you were writing on the board in any way?
No. I talked to Kip Thorne, who was a Nobel Prize winning physicist. He was actually lectured by Oppenheimer when he was a young student, so that was fascinating. My job was to kind of mine the humanity in the character. The people that understand quantum mechanics devote their lives to it. I could conceptually understand vaguely what they were after, but writing those equations became very soothing. It was almost like, I don't know, but you get into a rhythm, do you know? I remember talking to Matt Damon when he was doing, oh, what's the film where he did Good Will Hunting. Yeah, he said the same. It becomes a very soothing process just learning them.
Over the last few years, we've seen the most incredible amount of success coming out of Ireland, whether that's, you know, writers, actors. Do you have anything to say about why you think that's happening? Why now?
Part of it is coincidence. And I think part of it is that Irish people tell stories very well. Just in the pub to each other. We're good at it. We have a long history of it. We're comfortable with story, comfortable with song, we're comfortable with poetry. These things are just kind of second nature to us. But yeah, it is kind of phenomenal, the level of talent that the country is producing for like 5 million people. That's kind of extraordinary.
Cillian Murphy speaking to Katie Brassel. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Joe McCartney, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.